Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Big Blend Radio's military show. Every first Monday, we get to chat with Mike Guardia. He's a military historian, an award-winning author, a U.S. Army veteran, and really, I think it's 25 books. Every time he comes on the show, I'm like, am I right on this? Because there's always so many books in the works with him and being published. He was named Author of the Year in 2021 by the Military Writers Society of America. His latest books are Coyote Recon, The Forgotten Wars of Colonel J.D. Vanderpoel, also The Combat Diaries, True Stories from the Front Lines of World War II. However, he's also known for writing three books about Hal Moore. We all know Hal Moore, A Soldier Once and Always. That was the very first biography chronicling the life of Lieutenant Harold G. Moore. His leadership in the battle was in the movie and featured in the movie We Were Soldiers, starring Mel Gibson. Mike also wrote Hal Moore on Leadership, Winning When Outgunned and Outnumbered. The most recent book he has published about Hal Moore is Hal Moore, A Life in Pictures. In fact, Nancy and I got to go to the Hal Moore Museum when we were in Bardstown, Kentucky a few years ago. Nancy's like, hey, there's a Hal Moore Parkway. What? Text Mike right now. Mike, I think we're in Hal Moore land. And Mike gets on the phone. Yes, girls, there's a museum you need to go to, which we did. And we've done, oh my gosh, that was an amazing museum. But we're so glad to have Mike back on the show today because we're going to talk about Fort Benning changing its name to honor Hal Moore, the late and great Hal Moore. So everyone, Mike Guardia's website is mikeguardia.com. His books are all on Amazon. But welcome back, Mike. How are you?
Hey, Lisa and Nancy, I'm doing great. As always, it's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, we're excited today, you know, because Hal Moore, I think this is kind of what started your writing career in regards to military history and writing about soldiers and generals and telling the stories of heroes.
Yeah, the biography I did on Hal Moore, yeah, that was one of the first books I did. And it was an incredible project. I had a tremendous amount of fun putting that one together, not the least of which was for the reason that I got to meet Hal Moore himself. I got to spend time with him at his home and get to meet his family and, really get to know him on a personal level and get to know the family to the point where, you know, I really consider the Moores to be part of my own family, really.
Awesome. Wow. And did you awesome. Get to meet his wife as well?
Sadly, no. Tragically, Julie passed away, I think about, it was about 6 years before I actually met Hal Moore. Mm-hmm. It was an incredible loss. I mean, she was such a tremendous lady and touched a lot of lives, really did.
That's why I wanted to bring her up. We were talking, you know, we do our big daily blend shows and we always look at what's happened in history and pop culture and everything. And they were talking about, you know, military spouses, wife day, you know, and talking about what the military spouse went through. And I brought her up because she did so much in regards for women who had lost their husbands in war. Mm-hmm. And of course, now we're dealing with, you know, men and women, right? It's changed over a little bit over the years. And, but she really did a lot, don't you think, for the family?
Oh, of course. Yeah, she really went above and beyond any expectations for a military spouse back then. And, it's widely understood, I think, especially within military circles, that when you have a high-level command, you know, whether even if it's not a high-level command, even if you're a company commander all the way up through a brigade, battalion, and even a division commander, if you are married, then your spouse is in many respects your partner in command. And that's not to say that the wife wears the rank of her husband, but she becomes really the leader that all of the other military spouses look towards for any type of comfort, any type of any type of advice, and really to be a sounding board and to be a mentor, if nothing else, for all of the other military wives. And one of the best ways to keep morale in the unit high is to make sure that there is a family support system in place. And Julie was really a trailblazer in that regard, because the whole concept of a family readiness group, the thing that we have in the Army today, was just kind of a nebulous concept before the early 1960s. I mean, it was just understood that the wives had an unofficial social club, and that they helped each other out whenever they needed any type of assistance. Mm. But you had Julie, who pretty much took those ideations and she made a foundation for what would become the Army Family Support Network. And she made sure that all the wives were looked after. She made sure that they had resources. She made sure that there were certain co-ops on the base that could work together to make sure that no one single family member felt put out and that nobody felt left out. And it was really the concepts that she put into practice that became that foundation for what many soldiers know today as a family readiness group. And it stands as a testament to that old biblical saying that a good wife is more precious than jewels, and that that if you have someone who can be a reliable partner and be a sounding board and be someone who will have your back and is there to render that mutual support, then that really goes a long way into making a long and fulfilling life, not only for the other spouse, but for any other spouses that are part of whatever the husband's community of command is.
Oh, wow. So it's like a team together, and then a team is like for husband, wife, team for, or wife and wife, husband, husband, for the married couple, let's just say, and then for a team for the family unit. Mm-hmm. And then it goes into, okay, so these are the soldiers, on this side, but then these are the spouses of the soldiers. And so that's another two families in a way, it's like a big families, and I think that's something
it's
really big,
family support group.
Yeah. And full disclosure, obviously we pre-record our segments, everyone. And today we're recording this on April 15th and April, it's tax day. Yay. But it's but it's Purple Up Day. And I didn't know that this day existed. And that's why we do our big daily blend shows and kind of keeps us on track on why and, of history, pop culture and music and all that fun stuff. But then today is about the kids. And apparently April is the month of the military child, the military, family, and about honoring those kids that travel all over, which I was not a military brat, but you might as well consider me one, in that, Nancy dragged me around the world,
I don't want that word.
She didn't like the brat word, but
I don't,
I was
it.
A good brat, but Mike, but doesn't that play into what we're talking about with, Julia and having the spouse that supports, because it goes for those kids too, because they have to still have some kind of foundation and roots. It may not be of a place, but it's like the family unit has to be strong for the kids to be strong in life.
There's plenty of evidence out there. There are plenty of statistics and I guess even more pieces of anecdotal evidence that, that all tell the same story. Hey, when the family is broken and the family unit isn't strong, it's always a little bit stilting for the kids. It can go to the extreme where they start devolving into drug use and criminal activity, or, it could be something a little less extreme, like maybe, hey, I'm just very cynical in my outlook of the world. But there's always a sense of something missing, and there's always a stilted outlook of how you would view things otherwise. as opposed to if you grew up in a very strong family unit.
Well, okay, well, so this leads
me. We're social beings. We're social animals. We're meant to be in a pack, not meant to be loners. We are, you know, that is our upbringing. That's how we are. That's who we are. And so when you're forced to be a loner or forced to be on the outside, then you don't act the same as you might have acted. And I say might have. If you were in a loving, supportive family group. And I think, you know, we're social beings. We need to be in a lovely, loving environment most of the time. Really do.
I want to tag this into Mike's writing and Hal Moore, you know, who he was as a person. Because we talk about the family unit and what his wife, you know, Julia was like and what she did and what he did and how he took care of his, you know, his soldiers, his team, you know. But his also family. Go into Mike, because it's interesting, these unsung heroes, I'm going to say. Hal Moore, you know, obviously, you know, Mel Gibson in the movie show, you know, the movie, you know, showed his story, but and you've really continued his legacy, so people can get into the nitty gritty of it beyond just here's the hour and a half on the screen, you know, which was still great, but you know what I mean. But you tell the story of these unsung heroes, which a lot of times come from families that are disruptive. So it's kind of interesting to see, because it seemed to me that Hal Moore didn't have as much of a disruptive life as some of the other people you've written about, you know, even J.D. Vanderpool, right? And we were even talking about, you know, Lee Marvin the other day, and the last time on the show, Lee Marvin having kind of a similar pathway into the military and being a survivalist. So tell us a little bit about Hal Moore, because I think he was a little different than that, right, in his upbringing.
Yeah. So Hal Moore, really the broadest stroke that I can paint is that he had a very strong and tight-knit family upbringing. When I was interviewing him, I remember one of the first interviews we did, and he was telling me about his family background. He said, you know, hey, we had plenty of love, and we always had plenty to eat. We were very strong and very close-knit family. He said, we weren't perfect, but we loved each other, and we never felt like we were lacking for any affection or any of the bits of camaraderie that you tend to find in these strong nuclear families. And, you know, I think really that for him instilled a sense of a family in every unit that he was in charge of. He said, you know, I know that he was very, very family oriented in his outlook, not only as a part of his upbringing, but, you know, he had that same, he had that same mentality and that same spirit within his own family, the family that he built with Julie. And, you know, I think on some level, either consciously or subconsciously, he knew that when organizations have a familiar tone to them, when they have a familial environment, they tend to function a lot better, because there's that sense of loyalty and that sense of mutual trust and mutual respect. That's really not something that you can learn from a book. I don't know if that's something you're just ingrained in, something that's imprinted within your natural genetic code of talents, or if it's something you just kind of learn through experience. But it's unmistakable when you see it, and when you do see it, the units and organizations that have it are the ones that tend to perform the best over the long run.
I think it's trusted. It's also instinct of, you know, the other person like you know yourself, and you know, and there are expectations, of course, that they will behave in a certain way. And when they don't, it always comes as a big shock. But when they do, then you just take it as, yeah, that's how it's supposed to be. You know, so when you have a group of military people, be men, women, whatever, training together, that is what I think the training's about. It's really not. So, yeah, there's the clinical, like how to use a firearm thing. But I think it's more about getting to know the people around you so you can trust, so that you know second nature is going to kick in and that everybody's going to do what they're supposed to do when they're supposed to do it. That's my take on it.
Ooh, Mike, you're the one who was in the military. You did boot camp. Is Nancy anywhere close on that?
Well, yeah, and those are the feelings that really tend to take root, and it takes root in a very broad sense. Now, of course, you do have occasions where, I'm trying to think of the best way that I can describe it. You know, you have a certain dynamic, and there's a certain expectation within the military that, you know, when you're in those intense training environments, that you coalesce together. Mm. And it works. It really does work in the broadest sense, but then you always have a few people within every training unit who, for one reason or another, will become scapegoats. Mm-hmm. And it can be for a variety of reasons. I think the best way that I think I can describe it, I don't know if you or any of your listeners out there have ever seen the movie Full Metal Jacket, mm-hmm. but there was the character that was played by Vince D'Onofrio. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, here was a guy who we can tell was very well-intentioned. He was very well-meaning, but, you know, just had trouble grasping the military life. He was very childlike in his outlook and childlike in his mannerisms, through no real character deficiency. That's just, you know, how his heart and his mind functioned. Mm-hmm. But you know, he very quickly became a target. He very quickly became a scapegoat. And this is the one thing that you have to watch out for, because, you know, you see this a lot in military units, and to a lesser degree, you also see it in the civilian world, but it's out there where, you know, you have overzealous leaders who try to identify targets and scapegoats. They feel that they have to make an example out of somebody. Mm-hmm. And that one person or that one group of people, you know, they become targets for an overzealous, self-important leader. And the targeting turns into maliciousness. And that causes the intended target to crack and lash out in hatred. And if you follow that story arc, that's exactly what happened, like within the first quarter of the film Full Metal Jacket, because the D'Onofrio character, who they called Gomer Pyle, you know, they targeted him so much that he snapped, and you know, it was a very unfortunate demise for Lee Ermey's character. And you know, as you're replaying that, and as I'm sure that it shocked any number of audiences who saw it for the first time, just like it shocked me for the first time, you play all of the scenes in your head, and you have to wonder. It's like, okay, well, did Gunnery Sergeant Hartman contribute to his own demise? Had he not been so antagonistic and single focused on his behavior towards Pyle, could the outcome have been different? Is there, you know, because I think in any job, but more so in the military, just because of the nature of the work, you know, you have to be discerning about, you know, when the times are appropriate to proverbially kick somebody in the rear and give them some tough love, and when is the right time to, you know, throw your arm around someone and say, hey, you know, everything's going to be okay, man. I know you're trying, but you're not really cutting the mustard here. Because, you know, if you are too antagonistic and too harshly critical, you know, it never ends all that well. And I'm not excusing what happened at the end of that scene and that part of the story arc. But, you know, in by the same token, I have to say it doesn't necessarily surprise me, you know, because you can very easily push people to their breaking points. And, you know, you don't think about the second and third order effects about what happens if you just keep pushing people too far.
Mm. You know, it's like watching MASH with Klinger. Klinger just comes right out and like, oh, let me be the buffoon so that I don't have to go through the process of becoming it. Let me just be it. I'll take the hits for everybody. Here I am. I'm in a dress. I mean, I know
he wanted out of the military. But
yeah, yeah. Well, it was, you know, he's trying to get out. But I mean, it was a silly show, but it was really funny. And I thought he did a great job. But I also thought, yeah, he was the scapegoat for everything and everybody. And he just went there and said, okay, well, then I'm going to redress myself so I'm not really me. I'm over here as a woman. Take it out on that.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have like a shell. That is it. Like, I mean? There's.
So it's it's not really me, but I put myself out there and then just laugh with it.
Yeah. You've kind of put yourself in a second personality.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that you're not dealing with
it that way. Like, because I
internally
at first, when I first started watching it a long time ago, I thought, oh man, people in the military are going to be offended. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, that's pretty funny, you know? So, you know, and over the years, I just felt like that he willingly became the scapegoat to keep it off his friends and the people around him. And because he kind of felt it was going to happen anyway, so he just went there.
Well, that's,
that make any sense?
That's comedy too. Comedians mm-hmm. have done that most of their lives. And you'll find that comedians are always, it's your laugh or cry, right? It's the swing, mm-hmm. the pendulum. And I think that's that character too, where, you know, it's like, if you go to a funeral, you're either going to laugh or cry kind of emotion. And that's kind of that. I mean, people always think someone's always happy because they're making jokes. It doesn't really mean that's true. You know, it's everyone deals with something different in a emotion in a different way. And when you go into something like Vietnam, and I'm going back to Hal Moore on this, like, you're still in battle. There's still emotion, right? There's still fear. But the time is always, you know, time is ticking and things are happening so fast in a battle moment, right? And yet you've got adrenaline that takes over too. So your body chemically is doing all these different things. I don't know if they go into that in training, Mike, with what your body goes through, or like, you know what I mean? But there are chemicals doing things, right? Fight and flight and all of those responses. And I think that's, you know, going to Hal Moore, he had to look at, I think he got into understand from what I have read of your books and from the movie and everything and going to the museum is, I think he got to understand the people that he fought with and led. And yeah. He didn't just look at him as a uniform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was that same sense of family and that same sense of camaraderie that he brought forward into every single unit that he commanded. And, you know, you take a look at the downstream effects, particularly at the end user level, and you really see that sense of unity, that sense of camaraderie was so pervasive that, you know, you even years later, you have rank and file soldiers who served under him. They say without hesitation that, hey, we would have gone through hell and back for that guy. That's how much we respected mm-hmm. him. And wow. We put forth a lot of effort, not out of fear for what would happen if we didn't. We put forth a lot of effort because, by God, we didn't want to let him down.
Wow. Right. Wow. Because he cared for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think then that goes a long way in leadership. And do you still do speaking in leadership talks
On occasion, yeah.
Yeah, cool, because of the Hal Moore on Leadership book, winning when outgunned and outnumbered. And I think that is the biggest thing, is like they were outgunned and outnumbered. And yet he pulled things off miraculously, it feels like. But I think it came from him being a family guy, basically. You know what I mean? Having that care deep down. Yeah. Wow. And so that's a lot for people to think. Can you go into, for those who may not have seen the movie or read the books, can you just give everybody a little bit of an idea of what he did in some of the battles? And we talk about how, you know, being outgunned, outnumbered, you know, so because he is famous for some of his maneuvers and getting people out through battles, some of the highlights there. So people, just to jolt memories, and for those who may never have heard about him, especially when we think about the Battle of La Drang, what he did there, especially, I think would be something for people to know about.
Yeah, so at the Battle of La Drang.
Oh, sorry, I can't pronounce it. See, say that again. La Drang. La Drang.
La Drang.
La Drang. Okay, sorry. Yeah. Well, I always have to learn.
Yeah. Let's see. So if we wind the clocks back to 1965, the Battle of La Drang was really the first major battle between American regulars and the People's Army of North Vietnam. It was the first battle where we really had a solid, sustained opportunity to find out how the North Vietnamese fought and just how future battles would play out. And it was a measuring stick for both sides, because now we knew how the North Vietnamese fought, and now the North Vietnamese knew unequivocally how we fought. And the gut check for them was that they knew that it was not going to be an easy victory like it was against the French. They said, hey, the Americans have this thing called the helicopter, and it is a game changer. So we're going to have to try to figure out how to mitigate that the best we can, assuming we can. And you know, for as big of a battle as it was, I don't think it really adequately got the attention it deserved until Hal Moore, who was the commander of American forces at that battle, wrote his book some 25 or so years later called We Were Soldiers Once and Young. It was a runaway bestseller. It was on the bestseller list for, I wanna say, close to a year after it came out in 92. And one of the things that motivated Moore to write about it was, you know, by the late 1980s, you know, he'd been seeing a lot of the war films on Vietnam. And he said this in the opening of the book. He said, Hollywood has gotten it wrong every damn time. He said, you know, they've always, you know, there's always been a political agenda. There's always been a social agenda. And if you look at most of the Vietnam War films up to that point, he's right. You know, and you take a look at all those films like Platoon and Full Metal Jacket, so on and so forth. They all portrayed the Vietnam veteran as somebody who was malicious, somebody who was unstable, just somebody who you could say is a big misfit in modern society. And, you know, he wanted to get away from that and say, hey, look, you know, we were fighting a war that was unpopular, but by God, the soldiers who were there, they did their job and they did it well. And they did it the best they could, despite being hamstrung on so many levels. Well, that eventually got the attention of some Hollywood producers, and they made that movie, We Were Soldiers, which cast Mel Gibson in the role of Hal Moore. And I remember seeing it opening night in 2002 and just thinking to myself, wow, this is the first Vietnam War movie I've ever seen to actually portray the Vietnam veteran in a positive light, because I had never seen that before. And it prompted me at that point to learn as much as I could about Hal Moore and to try to contribute to the body of literature out there that was the counter revisionist, you know, to say, you know, hey, you know, Vietnam is not all of these, you know, horribly negative stereotypes that we read about so much, and you know, all of these horrible depictions that we see in the media. You know, hey, these were soldiers who were doing their job and fighting against impossible odds like many other wars that we've had. And, you know, they deserve a certain amount of respect that we should give to all of our returning war veterans. But yeah, that in a nutshell is Hal Moore and that snapshot of his career in Vietnam. And then, you know, if you just expand that, you see that he was fighting other battles on other fronts. I mean, you know, here was a guy who fought in some of the worst meat grinder hilltop battles of the Korean War. Of course, he did multiple tours in Vietnam and then was, you know, on the ground floor of rebuilding the army from, well, essentially rebuilding the army from the ground floor up after the post-Vietnam malaise.
Yeah, and he was, didn't he also fight in the Korean? I mean, he's done, wasn't he in Korea too? Korean. And then I was reading Old Baldy T-Bone and Pork Chop Hill. Where do they come up with these names? Somebody wanted meat. Somebody was hungry. They wanted a pork chop. Yeah. No, but it's interesting about Fort Benning. So Fort Benning is, you know, it seems that there was this bill that went out, or an authorization act in 2021 to change 10 army bases named after Confederate military leaders to be renamed. And, you know, we're seeing this with statues and everything, and it's really, it's, everybody don't get mad at me, but it's,
good luck.
We it's about not honoring someone who. And then the Civil War is so complex. Mike, can we do a thing on the Civil War at some point? Because it's so complex, because it isn't just what everybody thinks it is. And there were people that fought. There are people that fought just for their own homeland that didn't even understand half of what was going on.
You know, we're thinking like what we think now and what was happening there are two different things. We weren't there.
But of course, there were generals that were not that nice, and it's like Thomas Jefferson. I mean, it was his birthday the other day, and they're like, oh, honor Thomas Jefferson, and then everybody gets upset. And yes, Thomas Jefferson, he did some good things and he did some bad things. And I think when we look back in history, there's an interview coming up, and well, by the time this airs, it would have aired. We were talking about a legacy, your life legacies, right? I think Hal Moore has one of the most amazing life legacies, and so does his wife. Yeah. May we all, you know, work to be that, to have that kind of legacy, but no one's perfect, you know, and that's the thing, like you're even saying, his backbone of his family life. No, it wasn't perfect, but love was there. True love and foundation. No one's perfect because human beings are not perfect. I mean, we are complex, weird things. I mean, we're complex. We are emotional. There's chemical stuff going on. Like, I'm going back to the chemicals. It's a really good way to put things, but you know, and emotions are based on that. You know, there's heart and soul, of course. There's spirituality. So we fight on all these different levels: territory, religion, all kinds of things. Right? Possessive, jealousy. I mean, all this stuff that happens. And then we need the spirituality and the religion to balance us out a little bit and start getting back to our senses, and then we misuse it. So it's kind of interesting how we as human beings are. But leaving a legacy, and we look at these people, and I don't know if Benning, he's a Confederate leader, but none of us want to be pro, and if in our right minds, want to be pro-slavery at all. It's horrible. And we have slavery going on today. I want to remind people about this all the time. Yeah. We have slavery happening out of our schools with kids all the time. We have human trafficking that's happening all the time. Slavery has not gone away. And we need to remember the past. But changing these names is about not honoring those who did bad stuff. Right. But yet at the same time, the bad people sometimes did good. Am I saying any of this right, Mike? You got to help me here, because it's hard to explain this stuff, because it's complex, but history's rigging like a melting pot of crazy. I used the word crazy. Complex. I didn't want to.
it is very complex. And, you know, I have mixed feelings on the matter, because on the one hand, I do see some fair points to be made about some of the people who are saying, well, why do we want to honor these various army posts with the last names of people who we can categorize to be rebels and traitors to their country? But on the other hand, I'm still not convinced that renaming those posts is actually the right thing to do.
Exactly.
So I have mixed feelings about it. It's like, on the one hand, I see the validity of some points, but on the other hand, you know, I feel that, okay, is renaming these posts really the right thing to do? And not only that, you know, history is not really there for us to like or dislike. It's not there for us to try to tiptoe around. It's there for us to study and observe.
Learn.
And naming those various posts after those Confederate leaders, you know, for any number of reasons that they had, you know, I've never seen it as honoring their traitorous behavior. I've never seen it as honoring their rebellious nature. I've never seen it as honoring them being proponents for slavery. I've just seen it as, this is part and parcel of our very complex and complicated and our very immensely woven story of American history. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I've always looked at it. I mean, because I've never had a problem with anyone who attended Washington and Lee University, which carries its namesake from Robert E. Lee. I've never had an issue with us learning about the various Confederate generals. I've certainly never had a problem with the General Lee from the Dukes of Hazzard. I thought that was like the coolest car around.
I knew you're going to go there.
So I just don't think that renaming these posts is the right thing to do. Now, I am on board. Okay, I am on board with Mississippi changing their state flag. I'm okay with that because, well, you know, I mean, the Confederate flag, I think, is something that's best kept in museums, maybe best kept for like pop culture and stuff, but not something necessarily to be celebrated at the government level. But yeah, I mean, it is a completely complex thing. And while, you know, I will acknowledge the fairness and validity of some points that the other side is making, yeah, I still have to couch that against this gut feeling, I guess, if you want to call it that, you know, the renaming is just not the right path to go down. That there are other ways.
Well, I just don't want to, I don't want to lose the history.
It's almost like pretending it didn't happen, in the art world. There's a movement now where art statues done by artists 60-70 years ago are being torn down. Mm-hmm. And I feel the same way. You tear it down so you don't have to think about it. The whole reason it was there was for you to think about it. But the problem, from my personal point of view, is sometimes when you read the plaques, and I'm not saying looking at the sculpture, I'm saying when you read the plaques, sometimes they use the word honor, like, this sculpture was done in honor of. If they took the plaque away and took the word honor out and just said that this statue was commissioned by so-and-so to show so-and-so.
And why?
Leave the piece and leave the of art, because the artist just does art. Okay. It looks at the subject, it looks like, oh, okay, I was paid to do this, so here's my artwork. It's not political, usually. Not saying it's not always, it could be, but I'm just saying destroying the past doesn't fix the future.
Right. I think it's a very mixed bag, because it's really about not honoring. And when you have something named after someone, it's usually an honor of, you know, and so it's really difficult in the military when it's a fort and you know, a military base or something like that. My mind was always that it was about how they commanded during a military you know, a war or a battle or how they led troops, regardless of the side. Like Stonewall Jackson, I think, is a good example of a, you know, that was a story. Whether you are on that side or not, there's story, mm-hmm. battle stories are battle stories of someone persevering in their belief, right? I hate everything to do with slavery, and I do agree that we need to abolish even, you know, the KK people out there now that we still have today, and racism, and it's horrible. But right. Taking it away, I want like the good, bad, and the ugly to be represented everywhere so people can see the complexity of human beings. And like, hey, Thomas Jefferson, he had slaves, which was terrible. We should mm-hmm. not be doing this again. Here's some things he did or to consider and make your own opinion. Go do your right. own research, read, learn, discuss, and let's not be idiots. Let's not be cruel. Let's not be mean. Let's not be racist, which we have a real, the more things are suppressed, the more the underground racism and hatred, I think, breeds. And we don't see it in mainstream America. We don't. I mean, didn't we just see this recently? The more we suppress, the more it's breeding. And just because we don't see it doesn't mean it's not happening. And right. I want things out front, man. I want to see all of it. I want all of it out there.
Education is key.
Yeah, education's key. And it is opinionated. And it's also really, I think on the other side, we should touch on is, very difficult for those who have families that were in slavery and they're of descent. I think it's hard for them to sit and go, I can't swallow this. Like you're defending somebody who directly had my family mm-hmm. as slaves and beat yeah. them. Now that's hard. Yeah. So I think we can't, it's not a flippant thing. And so I think it's a discussion that has to be continued amongst all of us. And we have to fix things in ways of not repeating. That's
not repeating, but not removing, because if you remove it, you pretend it never happened.
I mean, that's Mike, eventually, wouldn't it be great if you had no wars to write about? Which we know it's not going to happen, right? You know, unfortunately. But can't we, isn't that part of, for you? About history is to have peace as we learn more is to understand.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think the study of wars and how they start and moreover the aftershocks, you know, the downstream second and third order effects, I think that's one of the biggest deterrents for future wars to happen. And it's a pipe dream to think that wars will ever end, because I know that they won't, but I'd like to think that wars are becoming less frequent now than what they were centuries and even millennia ago. And I think that's because, you know, over time, people have more access to the historical records and, you know, I guess more people are learning from history. That's why fewer people are repeating it. But, you know, history is always going to repeat itself in some form or fashion, because humanity doesn't really change. I mean, they can develop some societal checks, but at its core, I don't think humanity really changes all that much.
It's just sad. That's why I say slavery is still going on. It's just not in the way.
If you remove all of bad things, stories that and realities that happened before, if you remove that all, then it's bound and determined to happen again, because there's no guidelines. Yeah. You know, if they're there, then we go, hey, we did this like 40, 50, 60 years ago, or 100 years ago, didn't turn out that great, maybe we shouldn't do it again. But if you remove it and pretend it never happened,
then
we're just going to keep starting over from square one.
And we do have to stand up for things and injustices. We do. That's the other side. I mean, People put their lives
backwards instead of forwards.
People put their lives on the line all the time and die on the line all the time for other people and for peace and freedom. And that's not that is not a flippant thing. And yet now, you know, as we go forward in life these days, we should be able to speak freely, because even if it's wrong, it's up to society and for people to have that conversation and argue about it, whatever needs to happen.
That's because
but
have
it
that
shouldn't be suppressed.
Now.
That this the suppression is bad. Like, to me, that is bad. Once that suppression and people start like being shut up, if you don't have the freedom to write, to produce art, music, all the things that tell the truth, we're so messed up in that way. And so then it is like comedians. I mean, you cannot like their words or you can go against what they say, but if you don't, if you suppress it, it's going to go underground and it's not going to be pretty when it comes back out. I'm telling you, that's the thing. What? Underground stuff. Mike, isn't that right? In what, you know, in battles and underground stuff will always come out in places that you never expected, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Suppression is not good. We want to see what's going on, and you can have discussions. You can fix things when things are out in the open. And that's what transparency is about, right? We don't have that much anymore, but when, and in some ways we do, but let's go back to Fort Benning before we all get angry emails. And hey, if you want to send an angry email, send one, but if you want to have a discussion, like maybe do that. All right. So, cause none of us are perfect.
Right.
Fort Benning is being changed. So it will now be under Hal Moore's name, right? So it will be Fort Moore or Fort Hal Moore. This is all changing May 11th, right? To Fort Moore.
That's right. Changing to Fort Moore. Now, I mean, if we are going to rename Fort Benning, I can't think of anyone who is more deserving of that honor. Because if you are going to rename it, hey, by all means, I'm certainly on board with renaming it to Fort Moore. Because I mean, if you just look at everything that Hal Moore did and everything Julie Moore did, you know, I'd be hard pressed to find anyone who would be better served to
absolutely
an army fort named after them. I'm fully on board with that. It's like, yeah, you know, let's give it to someone more deserving. And you know, I think, and now that I think about it, I would be more on board with the forts being changed if there was a very solid reason for why you were making, or I mean, if there was a very well articulated replacement for it. Like, I mean, I want to, I remember Roy Benavidez was another person under consideration. And I'm like, heck yeah, let's go ahead and name a fort after Roy Benavidez. Cause that guy was just a machine in Vietnam. Not only that, it came over, he overcame some of the most horrific circumstances in combat that I don't think even the best war novelist could come up with, you know.
But that's the thing. I think it's like replace and actually do really good press releases and things and explain to people. Here is the thing. The changing of things, like statues, like Nancy's talking about the sculptures and statues, move them to a museum. Don't let them be the focal
or
point
just
of your town where
honor
you're honoring
out.
People that did bad things. Move them somewhere, like you were saying about the Confederate flag, right? Which flies prominently through half of our country that Nancy and I have driven on through.
It's crazy.
It's kind of like a punch gut. And I'm sorry, but it just isn't. There's just things that can be changed and still interpreted. That's where Nancy and I stand, is we don't want the history to go away. It just has to be redone. And every time you make a change is an opportunity for education, for, hey, this is who Benning was. This is what he did, the good, bad, the ugly. And here is what Hal Moore did. And dude, he's looking pretty shiny. And he's laid to rest at the fort. His wife is laid to rest. His wife's parents are there. So now what is their connection to Fort Benning? And that's something we should talk about, because you can't just go, hey, I'm going to name this fort after this, you know, general over here, even though, you know, they did all these amazing things. What's their connection? I mean, why are they buried there? Or I should say laid to rest. It sounds much better.
Right. Well, you know, it's, well, first and foremost, well, Fort Benning is the home of the infantry, and Hal Moore was an infantry officer, and the unit that he commanded in Vietnam that fought in those opening rounds of the Vietnam War, who fought at the Battle of Ai Trang, they were stationed at Fort Benning. And many of the critical events that shaped the conflict and shaped the aftermath of the army came out of Hal Moore's leadership and Julie Moore's leadership as well at Fort Benning. You know, it was not only them being the first ones to be sent over there in the actual combat mission in the first battle against the NVA. You know, while that was going on, Julie Moore was holding down the fort and rallying support amongst the wives. And being that solid rock, being that foundation that the wives sorely needed as they were getting news that their husbands were essentially being killed in action, you know, because it was a big point of heartache throughout the film, and it was recounted in the book. That you know, because the army was not prepared for the flood of casualties that early in the conflict, that there were no chaplains, there were no casualty assistance teams. They were simply giving these telegrams to the Yellow Cab Company and having these cab drivers deliver you know, the devastating news that their husbands had been killed in action.
Yeah,
you know, so being that was an incredible disservice, you know, Julie took it upon herself to, you know, deliver the telegrams and be that source of emotional support that the bereaving spouses desperately needed in that hour. And it was, I think it was from there going forward that, you know, Julie took it upon herself to really make sure that the spouses in every successive unit were cared for adequately and that they had support not only from the community, but from the top brass and from a lot of the lawmakers whose decisions would influence the course of the military. So, you know, given how all of those things grew out of the Moore's tenure at Fort Benning, that really why Fort Benning has become has really become the focal point for Hal Moore's legacy. I think also because Hal Moore settled just across the border in Alabama. He settled in Auburn. And, you know, the Auburn Opelika community has very strong ties to Fort Benning, which is just on the other side of the Georgia border. It's been a longstanding relationship, and it does not surprise me that, at all, really, that would be a place to carry his namesake.
I was going to ask, you know, When in regards to him being connected to that region, and her parents are buried there. So why were her parents involved with the military, or is that just because she had ties, or just a,
well, sometimes? Well, yeah, she was the only child born to a military family. Her father was actually a field artillery officer. And you know, he fought in the European theater of World War II. So Julie was already very accustomed to the military life, and it's one that I think really served her well and put her head and shoulders above most other military spouses, ones who didn't grow up with that level of familiarity.
I mean, she pretty much grew up on the base.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, so then where did you meet him? Like, when you met him, where did you go to meet him?
So he was at his home in Auburn.
Oh, so you were right there by Fort Benning then.
Yeah, well, I was at Fort Benning. That was during one of my iterations at Fort Benning. Then I went up to Fort Knox and And it was like right as I came down on orders to Fort Bliss was when we got underway with our interviews and started talking. And then I had been at, I had just arrived at Bliss when I got to fly out to Alabama to spend some time with him before the, yeah.
Wow. Now, how did you find out about him?
Find out about Hal Moore?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was the first thing where like, oh, I'm interested in writing about him or getting
yeah.
to know him?
So yeah, that was when I saw We Were Soldiers on opening night. I had a very passing familiarity with the opening battles of the Vietnam War, and I had never heard of Hal Moore. But the movie for me really was a game changer because it was after the movie that I ended up reading the book. And I mean, I was just fascinated, one, for the portrayal of Vietnam in a light that did not have any kind of negative connotations.
Yeah.
And also, I was like, hey, who is this guy, Hal Moore? And, what else has he done?
So but who as calls I started somebody reading, after that? Like, seriously, who says, oh, you know what, I'm going to go and try and meet him? Like, yeah, I'm serious, Mike. How many times I didn't go and try and meet Rambo, you know? Like, Nancy already met him, so that's fine. But, like, you know what I mean? Who follows that path? Because how many negative thoughts do we have in our minds, right? And so,
it motivated me because, you know, then a few years after I had read the book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, that's when We Are Soldiers Still came out. Mm-hmm. That was the follow-up book that he and Joe Galloway did. And, you know, I at some point I started looking for a biography on Hal Moore because I figured, okay, somebody had to have jumped on that by that point. He's got so much that he's done throughout his career. And I was surprised that nobody had yet done one.
Wow.
And, you know, I started thinking to myself, well, you know what, why not take up the project myself and see what can come of it. That's exactly what I did. And Hal Moore, of course, was still living at this point. And, I figured, hey, I'd contact him. And, you know, through enough persistence, you know, he said yes. And, it turns out that at the time, his youngest son was still on active duty. He was a full bird colonel at the time. It turns out that his son was on temporary duty at Fort Bliss right at the same time I was there. So I got to meet Hal Moore's youngest son. I introduced myself. I'm like, you know, hey, sir, this is me. And he said, well, yeah, Mike, you know, if you want to come visit Dad this summer, I can help facilitate that. And yeah, that's
cool.
Yeah, that is pretty much how I got my inroad to meet Hal Moore. And it was an incredible experience. Really was.
Awesome. I think it's wonderful. And I think it's wonderful that you followed a passion, you know, followed someone's stories and that you tell people stories, you know, and like I said, many that are unsung heroes, you give them voice. J.D. Vanderpool, you know, the last book, J.D. Vanderpool, but Coyote Recon, you know, but before that, Combat Diaries, as we see, you know, the end of the Greatest Generation, as we've talked about on the show before. I think it's just so important to tell these stories because there's so much bravery. And bravery is not just a word, man. It is really going for it. And really, when people put their lives on the line, that is, like I said, that is not a flippant thing. That is such a, we're privileged, all of us, to have people who do that for us. And so I think it's really important that you tell the story so people understand the people behind the uniform. Because uniforms can become a blur to people, especially on the news. And we forget that these are human beings, just like our neighbors, our friends, our family, who do this, men and women. And so we really appreciate it. So before you go, I know, Mike, we've kept you here a long time. You know how we talk too much, right? You know, we're good at that. But what's next? We want to know what's happening in the book department because it is 25 books, right? Are we at 25 now? Or not we, yeah. You. Dude, you're aging. Yeah. Just kidding. I'm teasing you. I'm nice, just saying, Lisa. Like, I'm teasing you because, like, seriously, He's young, but 25 books. Come on. That's a lot of books. That is amazing. I'm always amazed whenever you, you know, even like 10 books would be still amazing, right?
It should be like
right?
a history course. Like they yeah. should be in schools.
I know. If we were still living in one place, then we would have a whole wall of Mike Wardia. Like seriously, we have your books in our storage unit. We have very few things that we can't.
Seriously, one of the things that used to bug me about history in schools was somehow teachers made it exceedingly boring. Yeah. Now, if they had some of the books that we've been able to read, it would be totally exciting.
I would go to
why not? Well, it's a history of who we are.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be boring because it's not.
Mm-mm. Now you make history fun.
Yeah. And so I would like to see, you know, I really would like to see some of the films that we've been able to watch and some of the books we've been able to read in the classroom.
But
somebody
you've also
droning on yeah, about one date after another because dates not relative.
We can't watch anything military, read anything military without strategizing now. Now you've changed our mindsets, right? So now we're like, okay, like now did this, who did this? Like, okay, you know, it's because it is like a mystery, right? You know, battles and stuff. So it's like, we may not know all the technical terms for any of it, but by golly, man, Mike has got our minds totally shifted over into all right, this is going down.
See,
so and so is going to come over
real.
Here.
No, yeah. because he made history alive yeah. and real. And it should be, mm-hmm. if you want your kids to learn history, you need to give them the right books and the right films, and it has to be alive.
And everyone needs to read Coyote Recon because that is still mind-blowing, man. I'm still thinking about the big explosion. I can't get past that. I can't get past like the real big kaboom. Like he did that. He did that in the Pacific Theater. It's like, hello. Mm-hmm. Here we are, and yet, like, again, an unsung hero, right? And so, like, I still, but still, like, that's crazy. I still can't, like, I think about that about every week or so. Something will come up in history. I'm like, well, J.D. Vanderpool, like, he would have blown that up. Like,
watch this.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. But anyway, what's next, Mike? Sorry.
No. Let's see. Next is Fire in the Hole. And that is a story of the combat engineers in Vietnam. And for those out there who may be less familiar with what combat engineers do, these are the guys who set landmines. They do forced detonations of landmines.
Oh,
they
my
set
God.
Up, they set up the... They set up the barbed wire obstacles, you know, they dig the tank ditches, you know, anything that can trap the enemy and can impede their movement, they're responsible for. And on order, they can fight as infantrymen.
Wow.
So yeah, these are the guys who are carrying like the C4 explosives and just incredible stories from these guys who served with Charlie Company, the 1st Engineer Battalion. You know, they had such a critical role. And my experience has been that the combat engineers, they don't get as much press coverage. They don't get quite as much as, you know, the mainstream combat branches do, you know, like the infantry, artillery, armor, and so on. But, you know, just incredible stories all around. I think it's going to be one that resonates with the existing audience quite well.
That's amazing. Awesome. When do you think that's going to come out?
So I'm hoping to finish the first draft of that by the summer, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Yeah, that's fascinating because I know there's still mines out there. Like there's still areas, right? That there's still bombs underground. Like there's still like
where's
know,
that
some
place Lisa, we went where there's that camel statue and. The Jolly something or other, and they said
that's
still
quartzite, high desert Jolly. Yeah,
did where they say there's still things that you shouldn't go walking out there because you could.
Oh, but that wasn't like they didn't do like you know like I grew up learning about limpet mines, but so a lot of that is in testing fields. Like Kofa National Wildlife Refuge is part of it's a military base out there in Yuma area. That whole area there's. I mean, you can drive by tanks and General Patton did a whole bunch out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a bunch of POW camps out there too, that were out there. And the Germans and Italians would sit and drink wine and make and paint and do agriculture. Yeah, there's all kinds of crazy stories out in the Arizona desert. I tell you, you never know what happens in desert life. Well, Mike, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to our next time with you and everyone. We're going to be doing some special programming for Memorial Day weekend, talking about different military services across the country. So please stay tuned with us at bigblendradio.com. But of course, keep up with Mike. He's on amazon.com for his books and go to mikeguardia.com. He's on YouTube. Follow him on YouTube. If you're into military history, man, he blows things up all the time. Not really. He's not the one blowing them up, but he does put things blowing. Nice. I'm always looking like, Mike, what is that? You know, but that's the true geek out station. But also he's on Instagram now and Facebook and Twitter as well. Just look up Mike Guardia. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, ladies. Always a pleasure to be on the show.